Welcome to episode 27 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
So we are recording on Saturday.
January 16th.
January 16th.
So it's for the 17th.
Right.
Because they go out on Sundays. And the last one is up.
Yes, it is.
My blog is not.
And my blog has to be posted.
And yours is not. We're a little bit late.
Yeah, that's okay.
So, but the podcast is up, so that's good.
We should have everything set after by the end of the weekend.
Yeah, definitely. So, oh yeah, so my blog, administrative stuff. I don't remember.
I don't think we have any stuff there is, this week.
There is just one thing apart from being a little bit late this week. So I wanted to bring back a while back. We said maybe we'll do some articles that are not in the news, just stuff that we're really interested in.
Oh yeah, and you mentioned that.
Yeah, and I tried a couple times and really failed badly because I ran out of time. So I'd like to try this again.
Okay.
Right, but it's not news, right?
Right.
So we don't talk about it necessarily. Like if we've come across something, we don't have to talk about it at that podcast, right? So I'm going to talk a little bit about one thing I'm looking at, but it's because it's an article that I'm interested in, and I also did some work with G3 data to get data out of the article. I'll explain that later.
Okay.
So I want to go cover that, and so you'll hear about the article. But I'd like to go back to some of these articles that are quite a bit older, which are just really interesting. Every so often, you know, we go over.
To revisit.
And yeah, I miss that.
To share that.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds great.
And then the other thing is the last podcast, we totally forgot. And we didn't talk about Seneca Rocks at all.
I know, Seneca Rocks.
And we didn't talk about, there was something else. We really, was it the fire or?
Skiing.
Was it skiing?
Yeah, okay. That was in our notes. We didn't talk about skiing.
I don't remember what Seneca we wanted Rocks. To say about skiing, though.
I'm not sure other than how. Wow, we went skiing.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing. It was. Considering there was practically no snow.
And very warm weather.
Yeah, yeah.
And we expected nothing.
Okay, well, if there's not much to do with, like if that's all there is for administrative stuff, maybe I can do my blog.
Okay.
Even though it's not up. And the reason is that we can kill two birds with one stone. My blog was about Seneca Rocks.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Yeah.
And I did a fair bit of reading about it, but then when I wrote it, it was like all about the trip.
Right, right.
So we were driving up to Canaan Valley.
Right, which is in West Virginia.
All right. And on the way in, we were a little bit earlier than our kids. So we figured, well, we'll leave early. And we'll take part of the day at Seneca Rocks because we always see it driving in, but we've never stopped there.
Right.
And I have to say, that was really...
It was worth it.
Definitely. Yeah. So we parked at the southern parking lot.
Right.
On the east side, if you're coming into Seneca Rocks from
It's by Virginia. The visitor center, the one with the bathrooms. Well, but the bathrooms and the whole visitor center is closed during the winter.
Yeah, that's a bit confusing because there's another one up north.
I know, but it's not right at the road.
Yeah, okay, anyway.
But anyway.
And then there's the low water bridge, so to speak, which is fun to go across.
Right, because...
If the water's low.
I don't know if I'd take a car across it, you know, if you're expecting any amount of water.
Yeah.
It made me a little nervous to see people driving by and the water, you know, coming up on each side.
I don't remember anybody.
Two cars
went through.
Yeah. And I was like, how brave of you.
But no, but you. I think you can get out at the other end.
Oh, can you? I thought you had to come back.
That road goes on and on.
Oh, my mistake. I thought you had to come back. And I think.
Anyway, and then we found which I think, basically a climber's access.
Right. So we should describe what Seneca Rocks are.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So when I started to look at this, it's a while ago, so I'm not going to go into the geology because it was, I found it pretty complicated not having a geology background, but it was really cool to look at. But the non-scientific, just real basic, what happened is millions of years ago, even before millions of years ago, this is a real long time ago, there was an ocean, the Iapetus Ocean, and there was long or large areas that were basically sand banks, and the sand accumulated, and then ocean disappeared, and I better move this out, and the land got folded, forming ridges in the Appalachians, and some of those layers where there was that sand that got compressed into metamorphic rock, it became quartzite, and it's a narrow layer, about, I think, 250 feet, so I don't know, 200, or, I mean, less than 100 meters wide. And at Seneca Rocks and a few other places, they've basically been folded so they're vertical.
Yeah, it layers. Is.
Or they're on their side, in other words.
Right, and, you know,
or
well, you've had erosion take place.
They're 90 degrees to what they would be when they're laying down. That's the way to put it. And the quartzite is harder than the other minerals in the area.
Right.
So when everything else went away, you have these fins that are sticking straight up, which can be really narrow. I mean, some of these look just like a few meters.
Oh, you can put your arms around them easily.
Yeah, and some of them must go like 30, 40 meters high.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange formation and very cool to.
And it's in some places it looks downright blocky, the way it's been.
Yeah.
You know, when we're climbing around certain areas, it almost looks like someone took blocks out of the stone.
So we came back the next day,
right,
with our son Isaac and his friend Carr. And hiked all over the place. And
yeah, we expected it was going to be, maybe an hour to 2 hour hike tops.
And yeah. The first day, we thought we weren't going to stay too long.
Yeah, but the second day, we're going to leave it up to them.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, right. Yeah, we didn't know how long they'd
want. So maybe an hour, maybe an hour and a half. And we're like, fine, we're just going to enjoy this and be happy.
Yep.
And we ended up spending the entire afternoon and doing, like, what, 4 to 5 hour hike. And a lunch.
Found some caves.
And we found two caves. It is just a fantastic place to scramble around.
So that's one of the things that I mentioned in the blog. It turned out not really to be a science blog because I didn't have, you know, I didn't feel comfortable talking too much about the formation. But it has to do with how we explore areas. We really like to go to an area, and the very first thing we do is to go off to discover where people haven't discovered stuff, right? It's a whole concept of exploring.
Yeah.
And then we get lost.
Oh, yeah.
But while we're out there, that's not the feeling. It's like you're discovering, right? And then eventually, you find a major trail.
Right.
And you're still not sure exactly where you are, and then you start following, trying to make your way back, and then you make it back home. And that whole pattern of visiting an area is just a neat way of doing it, and it happens by chance.
It does.
So this time, we repeated the way up with Isaac and Carr. The same way we did it the first day. But then we couldn't find a safe passage through. So we came back down. We went around the rocks, still looking for climber's access type paths and stuff and indistinct ones. And found the caves, then went up this ridge And then we found the major trail. And
right. You
know, by that time, it's like, wow, okay, so this, we're done. And, but hey, this should be a way to get home or to back to the car in this case. And so we took that one. And so, I don't know.
And it was great. Car hadn't done a lot of hiking.
Mm-hmm.
And she was such a good sport about just being there and enjoying being out. And after, you know, after everything's done, you start to think about, okay, what made this day great? And one of the things we were thinking of, it's always nice to start with the toughest part.
And, yes, right.
And then, you know, have this walk that's just really easy.
For the way
path,
back. Yeah.
You know, 4-foot path that we could walk back almost, you know, shoulder to shoulder.
Yep.
To the car. And so it was a really nice way to end the day where there was not a lot of stress.
Yep. Yep.
And just, you know, when you're out with
people
for the first time, it's always nice to end on an easy street.
Yep. I totally agree. So your blog entry? I haven't seen yours.
So
you never sent it to me.
I know. I have it done.
Yeah.
And it's ready to go. So Patrick gave me two great gifts for Christmas. And one was a light.
Ooh. Almost lost
one
my
was,
beer.
One was a light. It's a floor light. And the name of it is actually in the blog, which I don't have access to right now. I do, but it would take a few clicks.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to control the lighting. And after having cataracts and then cataract surgery, what I found is that I can see, but I need to have a lot of light to see well. And having a light where you can control, like I have 4 different settings of intensity of light, and then I have 2 different colors for different situations, it's given me a lot more freedom for the reading and where I can do my reading.
I was surprised. There's the warm and the cool light setting. And I thought, I don't know why, that the warm would be better, but you naturally tend to always go for the cool when you're out trying to read.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about that spectrum that makes it easier.
And I think if I was working on like a pie or something like that, I would go for the yellow.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So I think it depends on the texture and the background of what you're working on. And to see what you can see. The other thing I got was a new Petzl headlamp that could probably blind anyone in the dark. And it's the Petzl Nano. And
oh, no, wait a second. That sounds close to it. It's the Neo?
Neo, sorry. I thought
I don't think it's a Nano.
Okay, Neo. Anyway, it is wonderful. I actually, when we were staying at a cabin, the cabin was a rustic cabin on a state park. And so the lighting is just, you know, basic lighting. And that allowed me to be able to read at night and in the morning because the other light was too diffuse, just having a single light.
Nail.
Thank you for the correction. And, the combination of the two has been wonderful. And speaking about that, I have to charge up my headlamp so it's ready to go for next time.
So tech stuff. It says the specs are for up to 575 lumens.
Yeah.
But we'll have more to talk about that because they have a pretty complicated system, it sounds like, for automatically adjusting how much it's putting out, depending on how much gets reflected back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't fiddled with that yet, but that'll be interesting to look at.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it because it might make it so that I can run around at night and do a nido with no problem.
Yeah, that was
where before I was thinking there's no way I can read a map. I can run around with you, but I don't think I could actually see a map well enough to follow it.
That was my main thought, yeah.
So that will be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So they were it was a very short blog, mm-hmm. but for people that have just had cataract surgery, hopefully you have found the light. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't, please check out the blog. Both lights are excellent and definitely worth purchasing.
Yep. Okay. Moving on.
Mm-hmm.
So, start off biology like.
Okay.
It looks like. I mean, I see what you have, and you have mm-hmm. Zika virus first. Do you want to start with the biology type stuff?
Sure.
I think it's good if we don't stick by, like, the publications we looked at, but rather stick by topic.
Okay.
So it's just a natural flow. And if we end with technology, it works better with finishing up with what we're doing. So, anyway, I don't have that one up. Did you have it in your...
I did have it. It's a Zernal article in mine.
Okay.
Yep, and it's underlined. But we... Okay,
it.
There it is. So, one article that I read from this week in Science was the Zika virus.
From this week.
Oh, from last week, I should say.
You keep going. I'll
Zika
look it up.
Virus. It was published on the 8th of January, 2016. And it is just rapidly spreading across Brazil. And it is very sad and how serious.
Are they sure they are sure it's the Zika virus causing
they are.
Birth defects? Okay.
And they've had, in a short period of time, they've had 3,000 cases, which is 20 times the usual rate, which is just...
Did they mention which mosquito?
Yes. It is the same mosquito that is used to transmit dengue fever.
The same one that transmits dengue?
Yep.
That is used to transmit.
That used to transmit.
It just came out sounding funny.
Yeah.
So. I don't see where it is. But anyway. Okay, so it's the dengue. Oh, here it is.
Yeah. I have it underlined.
Oh, it's one of the Aedes mosquitoes. Yeah. Anyway, so,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so, anyway, go on.
And, it is just one of those things that, they're trying to race to catch up to this disease
mm-hmm.
and find out what's happening. And, it is leaving, children with brain damage.
Yeah,
and
right. Microcephaly is the
microcephaly is the condition.
And I mean, all it is just a sign that the brain wasn't developing in the womb.
Right, and it is just.
So you know what struck me with this?
What's that?
The scary, but it's moving north, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it's in Brazil or if it's different places, but they were saying to women, don't get pregnant.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what's happening. We don't know where this is going.
Right.
And it's moving north, right?
Right.
And the furthest north, I think, is Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And so they're thinking, well, if we've got the cases of Zika infection. Actually, how do they know it's up that high? Because there's no birth defects up that
high. They look for antibodies.
Okay. So they know it's up into, people are being infected up
mm-hmm.
through to Puerto Rico. So they're like, well, women have been getting pregnant during this time.
Right.
So that's a really scary thought for someone.
It is.
Who's living in those areas where
oh,
it's
yeah.
just come, you don't know how badly your area's been hit yet.
No. And there's so many questions that haven't been answered. And one of the points they make in the article is like, wow, you know, with women that have been infected with dengue fever, do they mm-hmm. have antibodies that will somehow protect the baby, you mm-hmm. know, that right. other mothers wouldn't have? So not yeah. all the children are being affected. It's just, there's a lot of questions that at the end of the news brief, they have a list of questions that are just left unanswered.
Well, apart from the fact that we don't know why it's spreading.
Right.
Is also, wasn't, am I incorrect in thinking that Zika was actually not a dangerous infection normally?
No, you're right. It normally isn't.
So we don't even know why people, why
we don't know why it is more somehow it is impacting the children more, and we don't know if is it a change in the virus itself that has caused it to have a more virulent effect on the population.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to say.
Move to another one.
Yep.
Okay, so let's stick with biology. You look at what you have and I'll look at what I have. Let's see. I have biology and education, legal stuff. I
have the Iraq one.
I don't have much biology.
I have two biology.
The Iraq one?
Yeah. So the Iraq one.
Iraq
confronts. I put Iran. I mean.
So this is ecology.
Yeah. So yep. Iraq sure. confronts a new enemy.
Wait a second, but I thought I had other more. Let me just take a quick look, see if I can find.
Oh, shoot. Oh, I went. Oh, there, I got it.
You got it to a different desktop?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're using Linux. You have to deal with many desktops now.
I also have the Mammoth one.
No, okay, let's do Iraq, because I don't have any other
okay.
bio-type ones.
So, there's another article that came out the same time, January 9th, 2016, and it's the drought and dams allow salt water to invade and threaten people.
We're still in Science, by
yep.
the way.
We're still
the magazine,
in Science.
The journal Science.
Exactly. So basically, Iraq is suffering from drought, and the drought is causing their river system to be inundated with salt water, so that what the water that used to be fresh is becoming brackish and no longer usable for crops and livestock.
Yeah, some of what we're seeing, so they have a great map on page, 112, that shows through the years. And we're seeing some of this mismanagement, like mm-hmm. similar to the story when we did Lake Urmia in
yeah.
Iran. And part of it is the choice of crops. I mean, it's not all of it, but, you know, there's the damming
upstream. Yep, the water-intensive crops, such as rice.
But, yeah, and, like, yeah. the government on purpose wanting to drain marshes, which turns out to be an ecological nightmare in the long run.
Right. And also, we have the formation of dams. More, like, Turkey is building a dozen of dams in the mountainous headwaters yeah. of the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, and that has an effect further down.
Oh, I didn't realize. Look at this.
Yeah.
The Euphrates yeah. goes up into Turkey. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So that's the headwaters. So mm-hmm. Turkey has the headwaters. And, you know, as water becomes more important for crops and all different processes, it's very sad to see that there's the haves and have-nots of water simply because you have enough money to build a dam.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, the local impact of high or intense water crops also has an impact on the availability of water locally. So it goes back to mismanagement on both ends.
It's amazing to see the difference between 1973 and the year 2000. It actually looks better in 2009 than in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm. And one of the, you know, very last kind of sentence of the article, it says, the 2006 to 2010 drought is believed to have contributed to the onset of Syria's civil war. And, you know, when you have people that don't have a home, don't have a livelihood, it's very difficult. Like, then there's no food on your table.
Yeah.
And it causes all kinds of strife.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was...
Oh, did you see the part about the coral reef?
No, I did not.
So, at the mouth of where the Euphrates and the Tigris go into the Persian Gulf, it used to be there was so much sediment and so much fresh water coming through that nothing could grow just there right at the mouth.
Yep.
But now the dams are holding back the sediment.
Right.
And the flow is slower because of all the irrigation and then evaporation on the fields. So even, so the water, of course, like you said, it's getting more brackish even upstream. So a coral started to grow right at the mouth.
Oh, wow.
Or I don't know if it's right at the mouth, but it's
a little... Oh, that's crazy.
I can't find where I read this, but it's in that article somewhere. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I have another article. And okay. I actually talked to you about this right before the podcast because I was incensed about this happening.
No.
You have another one? Okay.
Well,
okay. No, go with yours.
Let's stick with the... No, it's... We both did this one, but I'm trying to find where it is. We want to stick to the same topics.
Okay.
And the grasslands one.
Okay.
Matches, right?
Yes, that would be better.
Okay, so this one is from also January 8th issue. and I guess it's a warning. William J. Bond, where is he? You know where he is?
Nope.
Look at the end. I mean, it's a news or a perspective or something. The Department of Biological Sciences, University of Cape Town. So basically this guy, it sounds like he's studying grasslands a lot. And he's making the point that just in recent years, our understanding of grasslands is just increasing extremely rapidly. A lot more research is being done. But for a long time, there was no research.
Mm-hmm.
And his point was that people used to think of grasslands as something that was not, usually not the normal state of the land in almost every area of the earth. And really what was happening is forest was the natural climax vegetation for most areas. And humans come into an area and then the forest disappears.
They clear the forest.
Yeah. And then
for fire, for crops, whatever, building.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you end up with grasslands and you end up with fires being caused by humans, which, and so there's all these restoration efforts to try to bring back the forests, right? And what he was saying is like, well, there's a huge amount we don't know, but one thing we do know is that this concept of all these grasslands are being secondary growths, so he differentiates between primary grasslands and secondary. Secondary being as a result of humans coming in. There's actually huge areas of the world that were probably primary grasslands, meaning that was the climax vegetation for the area, and they did burn. And if you look back through the records, through the archaeological record, he says they started to burn millions of years before humans had any impact. And so it's a natural
process
state.
Steps.
And he goes, and he says, you've got to be really careful about trying to put forests everywhere that are natural places, because you could be doing harm in some places.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically because the species from primary grasslands are different than those in secondary grasslands. And the big thing is they have all these adaptations for fire.
Mm-hmm.
And huge underground tubers and they he has this thing he calls underground trees, where you have all this network underground. And some of these places, he says, they burn twice a year naturally, others maybe once every 2 years, right? But they have to go through this process, and the secondary grasslands tend to not have those types of species.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we understand that part of it, he says, we really need a lot more research, because we can't yet tell that some place is supposed to be a primary versus a secondary grassland. Right. It seems to me like you should be able to, from what he was saying, the other rest of the article, mm-hmm. but I'm sure it's more complicated than he has the space to write about this. And one thing that I thought was really cool is there's a mystery, because even though these places have been burning for a lot longer than humans have been around, geologically, they've only been burning like this for, I can't remember how many millions of years or something, but it's relatively recent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it seems to match an obvious change in the climate of the Earth. Right? It spans over glacial periods,
mm-hmm.
right? So we have glacial periods and interglacial periods, and they go back and forth, and we've had these primary fire grasslands over many of these, right? So what caused this to start? Anyway, so that's really interesting. And that's part of the research that they want to try to do. Anyway, so I mean, it's not directly related to the Iraq story or anything, but it's ecology.
Yeah.
So I thought we really should do those together.
And since you went more on, you know, kind of a evolutionary route.
Okay.
I have a story, a new story, out of Science from January 14th, where grizzly finds suggest human inhabited Arctic in 45,000 years ago. And it's just a really cool thing. So they found this...
Wait a second. 45,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So that must be in an interglacial period, but like, wait, that's like before the last glacial maximum then, isn't it?
Yeah. So
or
that means that humans lived in the Arctic more than 10,000 years earlier than scientists believed. Isn't that cool? So
how could you live? I guess I don't understand even how you could live up there during that time. Or I don't understand when the glacial maximum was.
Right. Yeah, it's more of, I don't understand how they could live up there during that time.
When was the last glacial maximum? Or when were we in the last ice age?
It's not mentioned in this article.
That's, yeah.
But they were shocked that they found evidence that people were able to live there. And because of the archaeologic find of the mammoth that had been injured and cut up by humans.
See, I can't, it must have been in an interglacial period. Because I can't imagine mammoths being up too far north during glaciation.
Yeah, yeah. I it does not mention that specifically of the time as in glacial periods. But anyway, very early date for humans to be in the Arctic, and it was just kind of fun. One of the scientists said, wow, you know, if they were able to live there at this point, humans could be anywhere on Earth. So there was the appreciation of the incredible feat it must have been for a group of humans to live in the Siberian Arctic.
So, you know, it makes me wonder, how many interglacial periods have we been, for how many interglacial periods have we been humans?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, I mean, 10,000 years ago, it's not the, period where the Earth is like half frozen over Northern Europe. It's like, it's getting warm. But then, wasn't the cycle about every 40,000 years, 20,000 years, something like that, to 40,000 years from one to the next? I mean, you go back a couple of those and you're getting close to 100,000 years ago. Anyway.
So it's just, yeah, and I'm not sure of the time period for the glacial periods at all. So I can't respond to it, but they were just, you know, amazed that they were able to, you know, make shelter and clothing that they could survive in those particular environments. And then there was even mention of the Bering Straits land bridge that they could cross to the Americas.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That would have been around 30-some thousand years ago.
Right. That's why they said it's like over 10,000 years before that time that they were able to manage this.
Yeah.
So, very cool find. Apparently, if I have the story correct, a 12-year-old found the bones, reported it, and then they realized, whoa, this is a huge find. Yeah. He just happened to see it sticking out of the ground. So, interesting stuff.
So I have an evolution one now, if you want.
Okay, yeah, go
but
evolution.
It's really, I was going to actually do this last because this is not biology. This is like, but it's kind of related. So we really don't cover any of the stuff. I mean, not that we're trying not to, but we just don't seem to have a big interest in the fight over evolution in the schools and, but this is, I mean, I don't want to say this is funny research because it's not, but I just had a kick out of this. So this guy, let me see, is this out of January 14th again? Or I mean January 8th? No, this is from the January 1st Science. Nicholas J. Matsky. He is at Australian National University in Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so he basically looked at bills going through different state senates and assemblies, whatever. Being put forth to try to limit the teaching of evolution.
Right.
Because, or pushing intelligent design or equal time.
Oh, whatever.
All sorts of nonsense. And he looked at, he did statistical analyses on the wording, right? And he looked at the time and tried to match up what wording was used in, for example, one bill, and then was used right away, like as if it was almost copied, or maybe changed slightly, and how much was changed in a bill that came afterward. And he constructed a
evolutionary tree
of bills, and it's just crazy. So you can see at the origin, it's like all about evolution and the origin of life, and he starts around 2004. And then around 2007, it looks like, he's got a whole new branch that splits out where it's evolution, the origin of life, and human cloning and global warming that are the danger, and then it goes on. And one of the things that I remember, which was interesting, is there's, I can't remember half of this, but there was some tactic. There was, oh yeah, that's what it was. So I didn't realize, and it sounds crazy, but supposedly a lot of these bills have been, if they ever make it to law, get taken down in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that it used to be that even if you don't mention God, if you are trying to limit the teaching of evolution,
mm-hmm.
or you're targeting evolution in a way that says you want to teach intelligent design on an equal footing or something, because of the history of the country, the United States, that is evidence enough that you are trying to promote religious views,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you're mixing religion and state stuff, and
mm-hmm.
therefore it's unconstitutional, and boom, the law is taken down. Which I think is like, you know, we all know this is true, but legally,
right.
it seems like it's kind of a stretch to say just by, you know, you can't attack evolution for its own sake without being put in this class of religious,
right?
You know, although I can't imagine anyone attacking evolution for another
right.
reason the way it's been done, you know,
right?
And it's not like evolution doesn't have mm-hmm. really complicated issues that are not debated in science. It's just not what you see in the anyway, so I thought that was fun, and that supposedly that's the whole point why there's this new tactic, which is now sometimes making it into law and staying, where they're like, fine, we're going to attack human cloning and global warming mm-hmm. and other things like that, and so we're not just attacking evolution, and that's part of his chart, and you can see it's some bills that have actually been enacted into law.
It's crazy so. How he's made an evolutionary tree.
I know.
Of the legislation, he can actually follow it.
It's almost
way.
it's I wish. I mean, it's almost cute,
yeah.
but what I it making it look like an evolutionary tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It's not that it feels contrived to me. I mean, it makes sense what he's trying to do. I just kind of wish there was some geographical information that was easier to see.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of this has to do with your locality and the type of people that live in your area and their feelings mm-hmm. towards science and
yeah.
logic. And
yeah.
And... anyway, so, yeah.
Neat.
Although, reading it, I remember at the time, there was a lot about, you know, where the stuff was happening. And so, anyway. So, yeah, evolution. It's the title of his article is The Evolution of Anti-Evolution Policies.
That's funny.
Which is just hilarious. After Kitzmiller versus Dover, I think Kitzmiller versus Dover, I can't remember what the specific point of it was, but that was one of the major defeats for intelligent design being taught in the schools. Let me see. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Moving on.
Okay.
After our weird... are we done with biology type stuff?
Well, I have one...
One more bio?
One more, if you
sure.
consider this
oh.
bio.
Well, if evolution of legislature is bio,
okay.
I think we can do pretty much anything under biology.
So the BBC yesterday yeah. Posted, you know, the disaster of a clinical trial in France. And that left one man dead and three more having severe brain damage. So very serious situation has arrived there. And when I read about it in Science, you know, they're saying, this is what we know, this mm-hmm. is the drug we're testing. And I turned to Patrick and I was like, this is ridiculous. This should never happen. I can't believe this is happening. And then I'll have you say your response.
Well, I mean, I didn't know anything. You were saying it's ridiculous that anyone died in a clinical trial.
Right.
To a certain extent. I totally agree with that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked.
It will happen sometimes, but you should try to avoid it at all costs. But you were saying more than that. You were saying, shouldn't they have done animal studies so that you know going in, right? And my instant feeling was like, it's just too different. You do as much as you can in animals. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to tell you what's going to happen in humans. It'll give you a clue.
Right.
But the exact opposite could happen. You have many things that... And it's not animals versus humans, right? It's species versus species.
Yeah.
When you're talking about putting drugs in animals and like mice versus rats versus pigs versus humans, some of them will work the same across the board. And one drug... for some strange reason, in one particular species, we'll just kill it mm-hmm. because it happens, you know, so it's pretty rare, but it can happen.
Right.
And certainly what happens all the time is a treatment in one animal will make another animal very sick.
Right.
Or will have no effect mm-hmm. in the other animal. That happens all the time. And that's why we're constantly doing animal studies. So, but this was a phase one, so that's what it's supposed to test. And, you know, I was like, well, yeah, it's sad, but, you know, one person died, several got really sick. You know, that's going to happen sometimes. And then you said that
there were only
seven people in the study. I'm like, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Right.
But it must have just been the start of the study, because you don't do studies with just seven people.
It was. There were, it was just very shocking. It was a drug being tested by the company.
Do you remember what the drug was?
It's from the pharmaceutical company Bial, B-I-A-L, from Portugal. And it was a neurological psychiatric It was to treat neurological and psychiatric pathologies. And it was in its phase one of testing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, just, you know, it was a real shocker to me to read about it, only because it's so unheard of in the drug trials that something this bad
happens.
And to have all of the patients or the patients having some degree of trauma after. So anyway, I thought it was worth mentioning, especially with my response and your response, that I thought it was important to discuss.
Yeah, we had different reactions to it. Yeah.
And it helps give perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you have?
So are we moving away from biology mm-hmm. slowly? So this is actually kind of bio. Actually, if we want to go into like renewable resources and that type of stuff, this is the bridge. Mm-hmm. Massively cool finding. I have to say, we are being pretty superficial this week, I feel. Mm-hmm. And part of it is we've been just really busy. In my case, we'll talk a bit about building the IRDF transmitter, mm-hmm. but that's going really well.
Right.
And I'm just dying to get it done, so spending all my time. But, so, to get back to the article, mm-hmm. this one's out of January 1st Science. There was a perspective on it, and I basically really only had the time to look at that. So, the idea goes like this. You want to make biofuels, which, as an aside, I hate the concept of biofuels. Mm-hmm. Any, you know, when we have ways to to store electrical energy and use it. And but anyway, so we'd like to make biofuels because fuels generally are a very dense way to transport energy, and that's what you need in for like cars.
Right.
And you can get bacteria to create biofuels. In particular, there's a certain type of bacterium that are called acetogens. They form acetate and some other stuff, which then can be used in your biofuels. The big thing is that somehow in creating these biofuels, you need to take carbon dioxide and reduce it. And you reduce it with hydrogen, molecular hydrogen. And it's got these electrons. And these acetogens, they tend to live in areas that are dark. And then they can use the hydrogen. And they can reduce the CO2 and make acetate, which then you can use in your biofuels. Okay, so then you have to get them the hydrogen. Right. And then it takes energy to make the hydrogen. Right? And then you're going to use, you're going to make CO2 and stuff. So one way to get hydrogen is to electrolyze oxygen, I guess. I don't think they talked about that here. Right. But you could imagine you set up solar panels, get electricity, electrolyze water.
We've done that with the fuel cells.
Get oxygen. Well.
Yeah.
I guess that's basically what's happening. Yeah. You're totally right. So you get your hydrogen and your oxygen. The hydrogen you feed to your bacteria. They make acetate out of CO2. You feed them CO2, of course, also. And they make acetate. And then you can take your acetate and you can burn it. And you can do that with other bacteria that make ethanol and whatnot. Okay. So what these people did, to jump right to it, I'll get back to some of the earlier stuff, is they grew some of these bacteria with, let's see, cadmium and cysteine. And the cadmium sulfide that is formed in the solution precipitated on the bacteria, forming this little coating, little dots of cadmium sulfide. And then they could shine light in their solution of these bacteria that usually grow in the dark. The cadmium sulfide acts like a solar cell, captures the photons, right? And I think cysteine is reduced to cysteine in the process, and the electrons are then transferred to the bacterium right into the acetate biochemical pathways, supplying the electrons instead of the oxidation of hydrogen. I mean, is that amazingly cool or what?
That is really cool.
So these bacteria, which are normally grown in, which normally grow in the dark, get coated with basically their own tiny, minuscule solar panels, and they make biofuel for us. I thought it was just amazingly cool.
Yeah, mind blowing. It's awesome.
Yeah, just fun. Let's see. Did they have anything else that was interesting? I guess it'd been, this is like the latest in a bunch of research. The bacterium they used was Morella thermoacetica. And I think this bacterium, if not this one, some other one that uses hydrogen as a reducing agent.
Right.
Had actually been shown to be able to produce biofuel by putting them in a chamber and putting an electrode in there.
Right.
So you kind of dispense with the hydrogen and the bacteria start to aggregate around the electrode. If I remember correctly, I'm kind of.
That is just not too sure. Cool.
But this is like all in one, right? So. Holy crap. Kelly just showed me how long we'd been going.
Yeah.
With nothing to talk about. We're over 55 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So I thought maybe we should go on to projects.
Okay. Let me see if I have anything else.
Oh, sorry. Because the last one was really cool. Okay.
Yeah, if we just do one more on the science. Mm-hmm. This was kind of cool because perovskites have been coming, and it's also solar cell type stuff.
You mentioned this one to me in the car.
Yeah. Looks like January 8th issue. Mm-hmm. So perovskites, I mean, they're not as good as regular solar cells made with silicon, and certainly not close to the, is it gallium arsenide that they use in satellites and stuff, mm-hmm. which have just unbelievable conversion efficiencies. But anyway, I didn't realize, it's not just they're not as good as silicon, but they degrade ultra fast. So you take perovskite and you put it out in the sun.
Yeah.
And it'll degrade very fast, you know, like minutes, I guess. Mm-hmm. So the cool, but it's, they're getting better and better, right? Mm-hmm. And they're a hell of a lot cheaper to make than silicon. So people are really hoping that this will be a big boost to the industry. Mm-hmm. They've been getting better and better at efficiency. What they found in this article was that if you add cesium to your perovskite, they become hardier.
Mm-hmm.
And they can withstand for a lot longer increases in temperature and in sunlight. So that's kind of cool. But the other thing that's kind of neat is that the silicon tends to absorb light more in the blue side, mm-hmm. and the perovskite more in the longer wavelengths. So people have been trying to put the perovskites over the silicon because you can make the perovskites really thin. Mm-hmm. So the short wavelength light will actually make it through the perovskite pretty easily and make it to the silicon. So you could actually get efficiencies higher in your, you know, in your total solar cell than you would with just silicon by itself. The cool thing is that the cesium shifts the band gap of the perovskite so it absorbed in even longer wavelengths.
Yeah.
So it makes the combination even better.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
So you could even say they're more efficient.
They are.
Yeah.
No, there's no question about it. They are more efficient. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They call them tandem cells.
Interesting.
So...
very cool.
Oh, wait a second. I think I said it totally backwards. Sorry. I misspoke. I hate when I do this. I think it's the silicon that absorbs in the longer wavelengths. Because here they're saying tandem cells perform better, researchers widen, than that by pushing the band gap of perovskites higher so they will absorb even bluer light. That would have to be away from... so, yes. Mm-hmm. Right? So... let's see, silicon has a band gap of 1.1 electron volts, and perovskite 1.5 electron volts. So that mm-hmm. would be shorter. That would be more blue because it's higher energy.
Right.
So, yeah, I said it backwards. Anyway, that's the idea. So I thought that was one more step forward towards future without using fossil fuels would be very cool.
Yes, it would. So,
what are you looking at?
CamJam EduKit 3.
The CamJam EduKit 3. So are we going totally on to technology now?
Yep.
I really don't have much. This was from the Linux Voice.
Looks very cool.
You see, issue 23. And Andrew Gregory, one of the guys part of that team, he reviewed the EduKit 3. And it's like a little robot. So when I saw this, I thought of your kids. Let me see. It's part of a whole series made by the Cambridge Raspberry Pi Jam team.
Nice.
They have a distance sensor, a black and white boundary sensor. And of course, you know, you can hack all sorts of things onto it. It's really small. It comes in a little box. But it's like, it's got a whole education little kit that goes with it. And the kids have to answer questions and stuff. There's the projects are on their website. And they have worksheets. And I thought, oh, this is kind of the type of thing that we're interested in doing as the Island Creative Time projects for the kids. And
yeah,
we're still, until we get the art of going, it's that's going to be kind of on hold. But
that's a really cool
it seemed really neat. Anyway.
Set up.
So that was a neat thing I found on their site.
Nice.
And then the other stuff I think is not as important. Except I really got into RSS.
Yes.
And the reason I got into it again is I always have one up, but I don't, I've never really tried many different readers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, they had some RSS stuff on their last Linux Voice issue. And so I started to look up all different ones, and I found some that I thought were a lot of fun. Newsboarder was one of them. So let me see. Although I don't know, there's some things that it's missing. I like the KDE one, aggregator, I guess is the way you'd say it. So anyway, that's actually really, I had a lot more in my notes, but I think that's all I want to do.
Okay. And so does that bring us to future plans?
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, that and what we've been working on.
Right. So future plans with our mapping and flagging of Falls Lake. We've had a bit of a setback.
Well, you broke your foot.
So I'm not doing anything.
So you didn't do anything. I have to say, last time I didn't go, and that was a choice that was separate from that.
Yeah.
Because I was worried about getting the transmitter finished. Mm-hmm. Now we know it's happening. It's really going well. So I will go out there. So the transmitter. The one that we're putting together by module is
right.
put together. I'm working on the code here and there, but I kind of stopped this weekend because, I mean, it's working.
Right.
The power chain's working, and the complex code for making an RDF1 we had working in the Microfoxes before. So it's probably not going to happen, but I'm desperately going to try to get it done by by the end of Monday.
Very cool.
Because we get Monday off. And if that's the case, we should get the boards back by early February from Osh Park. And so we could probably have three built by mid-February.
Right.
And actually be able to plan something with the Enrichment Club at Smith Middle School.
Which would be pretty cool.
Which would be very cool.
Yep. Nice.
I think it's really important to get a couple of them, of the Enrichment Club things done before the end of the year. One to show the kids, okay, this is how it works, and so on and so forth. And then one where they actually go out and play with them, kind of can do more whatever they want. Let them loose and have them try to find them around the school. So
right.
And then if that works, maybe we can get some interested in doing it during the summer. We'll see.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds very
good. So that's the plan. And I will put everything eventually up on our site.
Yeah.
So that people can,
right.
can put theirs together and stuff. This is totally going to be free for people to look at everything I've done. But that takes work also.
So it does.
So it's going to take time.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure I'm not going to put out. You know, right now, all the stuff that goes on as blog entries is more like updates of progress and interesting concepts, but it's not really the documentation, of course.
Right, it's not the completed product.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good stuff.
Future plans, more work on OCAD.
Right.
Oh, I didn't talk about G3 data.
Nope.
Maybe we'll...
Come back to it?
Skip it until some other time.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
How'd you like my notes?
Very good. I did go back through them.
But they were on a PDF this time because I was using LaTeX.
Yeah.
Maybe next time you'll be able to talk about using LaTeX.
That's true. That's true. He's trying to convert me. Okay.
I gave up that fight a long time ago. But you came back, right? You're using Xernal. You're on a Linux computer right now. So.
That's true. Okay. So it's time to wrap up.
I'm looking at what you wrote. Green versus hash green?
That was for our orienteering mapping.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we didn't get actually to open orienteering and to start thinking about that. So. Okay.
That's the only other thing I saw there. Okay. Well, then, that's it. So thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.